America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
It has been such a pleasure being part of the integral team here at Jews United for Democracy and Justice. And also so great to have Tim on, because Tim's been on my show many, many times, and we've never actually done this face-to-face. So I'm excited to see you and to have you. And just as a brief bio, so people know exactly how great you are, you are a senior research scholar at Columbia University's School of International and Public Affairs, and also a CNN presidential historian. You used to be at NYU, where you were a clinical associate professor of history and public service. You were also the director of the Richard Nixon Presidential Library, and we'll get into some comparisons between Nixon and the current president, I'm sure. Tim's books include the biography George H.W. Bush, Impeachment and American History, and co-author of the book Khrushchev's Cold War, The Inside Story of an American Adversary. Tim, welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. It is a delight for me to be here. It's nice to see you. I am very grateful to Mel and Zev and Janice and Jews United for Democracy and Justice for inviting me today. And I look forward to our conversation.
Me too. All right. Well, the topic of the conversation is democracy stressed. Can American institutions still contain political extremism? So I guess given how far the sands have shifted and the lines moved, how do you define political extremism now on both sides of the aisle?
I define it in these terms. Are the advocates of that approach trying to undermine our Constitution? And what do I mean by our Constitution? I mean the following basic principles, which we can discuss more later. One is democracy, the right of every American citizen to make their voice heard, and to vote. Two, the right of every American to speak her mind without fear of retaliation. Three, checks and balances. No imperial presidency, no imperial Congress, no imperial Supreme Court. Three, equal branches that rub shoulders all the time, make each other angry from time to time, but effectively work together. And out of the sausage, I'm sorry to mix metaphors, comes policy. And four, blind justice, a sense of fairness, a sense that the system in the end, that everyone is innocent until proven guilty. So our Fourth Amendment protections, for example. I think that is absolutely essential. So any group that seeks to abridge any of these principles, I would consider to be extreme. Obviously, understood in this is any group that seeks to use violence to achieve their ends, which is it contradicts in all of the principles that I just mentioned, but I didn't say violence, but I hope it's understood that anybody who seeks social, political, or cultural change through violence is an extremist, in my view. So the question is the system robust enough to deal with people who are playing a kind of hardball where they are, again, mixing metaphors, coloring outside the lines to ensure power. And then we can talk about the extent to which that is extremism. But that's how I view it. It's not whether you support one particular policy or another. again, all of the principles I just mentioned would prevent you from acting on racist principles or any, which again, I would consider to be extreme. But if as long as you are playing by those rules, then it doesn't really matter to me what your policy views are, whether you're a socialist or a conservative. It's not up to me. As long as you're playing by the rules, and the rules are set by a constitution. So that's how I view it.
However, it seems to be that people on both ends of the political spectrum, and probably also in the middle, think that there are different ways of defining the ideals that you have outlined, and different ways of interpreting them, and also thinking that they are being abridged by the other side.
Well, that's the problem today, which is that many Americans, and look, I'm not a sociologist and I'm reading the polls that everybody else reads, okay? But most Americans think that there's something deeply wrong with our society and that it's an unfair place. Most Americans correct. Do. But they don't necessarily all support President Trump, but they do. So there's a sense of unfairness. And what happens when people feel that a situation is unfair is they begin to say, well, look, if they don't play by the rules, why should I? I'm being disadvantaged because I'm the good guy and they're messing with me. So yeah, we're in a toxic moment when people don't trust institutions. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of dislike for each other. I don't mean your neighbors. I don't mean your family. Well, I don't know family, but you know what I mean. I mean, there's this sort of abstract dislike of Americans somewhere else. And that, by the way, it's pointed at the vectors are in both directions. So if people don't quite like each other, I'm speaking nationally, and if they don't respect institutions and they think the systems around us are unfair, that lays the groundwork for coloring outside the lines, if you will. And that's where we are right now.
And the big questions, of course, are what is causing this? And there's so many ideas of, well, is it the media? Is it social media? Is it the, the economic inequality? Is it our leaders leading us into these extreme positions of vengeance, violence, and recrimination? And I guess it's maybe a combination of all of this, but as someone who has studied historical patterns, where do you find us now in a more historical context? Are we at an extreme point in our history, in our political history?
At a certain point, we're going to talk about Richard Nixon and the 70s.
Yes.
But before we get there, let's talk about how I try to explain to myself and to my students how we got to where we are now in terms of this toxic, poisonous political culture that we have. Some of it goes back to 9/11 and the effect of the shock of 9/11 on Americans and the wars that ensued.
Say more about that, because we tend to look at 9/11 as an attack from the outside. And what we've been discussing is attacking each other. So how did that translate into an internal division?
Well, part of it is that despite the efforts of George W. Bush to not to make the same mistake that Franklin Roosevelt had made after Pearl Harbor, and allow Americans to feel that the Japanese among us might be threatening to us. You remember, after all, we sadly had Japanese, those Japanese internment camps.
Yeah.
George W. Bush, a couple of days after 9/11, actually goes to a mosque in D.C., which is a very, very symbolic moment. And I've always felt, and maybe because I wrote a book about George H.W. Bush, I always felt that Father Bush had played a role in that, because Father Bush remembered the excesses after Pearl Harbor. He had fought, after all, in World War II. And George W. Bush was making the case that the issue here is not Islam. Okay, it's criminals. It was just as we were against Timothy McVeigh and the attack at home in Oklahoma City. That didn't mean all Christians were murderous. So too should Al-Qaeda not be the reason to consider all Muslims to be potential terrorists. Despite George W. Bush's efforts, I'm not sure that all Americans quite got that argument. And so there's a little of the American intolerance among some for Muslims that I think was a product of 9/11. But more importantly to explaining the shift in our political culture is Iraq, not Afghanistan, although Afghanistan would last longer as a conflict than Iraq. But I think we mustn't underestimate the effect of the Iraq war on us at home, and particularly on a generation of Americans who fought there or were in some way affected by that war, because we weren't able to explain to ourselves why we were there after a while. We thought we knew why we were there, and then it turned out that the reason we thought we were there, WMD, didn't exist. And so we suffered the pain of losing servicemen, of people losing years of their lives, whether they came back with their life, but it had been altered, it had been changed. The cost of this war and the enmity that this war created, and then the follow-on response, which was ISIS. ISIS there and then ISIS here. So many Americans, there was a sense that our federal government had become an imperial government, even though it was a Bush administration. A lot of people became not only disenchanted with politics, but disenchanted with the established parties. So I would say those are two reasons. Now, something else is important. The Great Recession. The Great Recession hit Americans differently, and not all Americans recovered in the same way from the Great Recession. And if you look at income inequality, which had reached a sort of a national or historical level, a good in a sense that we were a less unequal society economically in the 70s. By the 2000s, the Gini coefficient, which is an estimate of inequality, showed us becoming a more and more unequal society. And the Great Recession made it worse, because if you look at counties in this country, I did this analysis once. I was trying to help my students understand the 2016 election. So I looked to counties that voted for Obama in 2012, and then I looked to see if they voted for Obama or Hillary Clinton, and a number of them flipped over to Trump. And then I looked at the economic effect of the Great Recession, and the counties that flipped to Trump in 16, for the most part, were counties that did not recover as well as other counties after the Great Recession. There was economic hardship there, and they didn't want the Democratic Party anymore. They wanted somebody new. They wanted someone to shake up the system, who promised to be on their side. So the Great Recession also, I think, created a sense of unfairness, a sense in not just rural America, but in many parts of rural America, a sense that the system wasn't fair, and contributed to what we're suffering today. Then you have President Trump, Donald Trump. And Donald Trump is once in a generation, charismatic leader who was able to mobilize this anger. Mm-hmm. But it was already there. Right. He could not have created it. Similarly, yes, the Russians messed in our election in 2016, but they didn't create the divisions in our society. They just did their best to magnify them. And frankly, we don't even know the extent to which it mattered. It just helped along the argument that those who said the system has to be overthrown and changed were making. And by the way, the people making that argument were not just Republicans. It was also Bernie Sanders. I mean,
well, that was going to be my next question, because here you have Donald Trump, who answers this anger and disappointment and desperation on the part of many Americans, their economic sense. He promises he would never get into a war like Iraq or Afghanistan. He's got this America First agenda. And so does Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders says kind of the same things wrapped in a different package. So I guess my question is, if people were so dissatisfied, why wasn't Bernie Sanders the nominee?
Well, I think that's a great question, Madeline, and it's a question Democrats ask themselves all the time. Particularly, I've been reading some Democrats who were saying that Bernie should run again. He apparently played some pickup basketball the other day and seemed so energetic that maybe at 86 or however old. Here's the thing about it. It's not my wheelhouse, but it has a lot to do, I think, with the structure of the two parties. The Democratic Party was still President Obama's party in 2016. Mm-hmm. President Obama, which we would learn later from Vice President Biden, later President Biden, President Obama had decided that Hillary Clinton should be the nominee in 16. He did what he could to push gently, not so gently, Vice President Biden out of the way, and did a lot to help. I mean, Hillary Clinton was a powerful candidate without Obama, but to have such a popular, very important person as your ally, I think, made the difference. And so I don't think it was ever, and Bernie Sanders came awfully close for someone, you know, remember it. I mean, he came awfully close in that race. But I think that's what it was. I think President Obama was still in charge of the party. Hillary Clinton was his choice. I mean, after all, she won more votes, but he was helpful. I think that may have played an important role in 16. 20 was a whole different story. And there I would add to the sort of the destabilization of our political culture, there I would add the pandemic and the whole MAHA movement, which was an important additive. They don't like additives, but it was an important additive in 2024.
They like some additives.
Well, apparently. Yeah. They, particularly if you can make them in a smoothie, but anyway, you can't imagine them without the pandemic. They existed before. I mean, after all, Venice Beach existed before. I used to live in California, so I sort of know a little bit about this, but the pandemic really makes MAHA into a movement. And so the pandemic is it also sort of undermines a lot of trust in institutions. The public health choices that were being made were obviously, we all remember how controversial they were, despite the fact that people were actually dying from COVID. All of these factors, and then of course, sort of magnified by the media and by the development of social media, lead to this toxic political culture. That's how I view it. I don't think any one of these factors alone could have produced the really difficult situation we're in right now.
Right. And I don't know if you answered my question from, you know, a while ago, but let me bring it back to sort of where you place our current era in the history, maybe the recent history going back to maybe 100 years. So there were problems in the 20s, of course, with the Jim Crow era, upheaval and division in our country. Where do you place our current era?
I think that in terms of fairness, we are still much better off than we were 100 years ago. In terms of income inequality, we're actually, for all the billionaires, we're still better off than we were 100 years ago. What has happened is we've lost some of the gains that we had attained by the end of the 20th century. We are certainly better off than we were 100 years ago. But we're in some ways not better off than we were 50 years ago. And I think that's the, and for, or for people,
that's what people remember.
That's what people remember. And that's why I wanted to mention briefly the Nixon story, because the Nixon story is in the end, a story of the strength of our system, of our institutions. Now, it was a near run thing, because if Nixon hadn't been so so insecure that he taped everything, and the tapes, you know, he didn't burn them, thank goodness, though he got advice that he should destroy them. The question was, he'd have to build a huge bonfire to destroy all of them. That the tapes did him in, and he probably would have had to resign without the tapes, but it's not clear. But he did resign, and the system worked, and it worked in a bipartisan way. That's the part that's often missed. Republicans realized he needed to go too. And for many Americans of a certain age in that era, there were lessons that they learned about the imperial presidency. And for them, Vietnam was their Iraq. And Vietnam was something they didn't want to see repeated. And so they wanted to find a way to make sure that the presidency remained a co-equal branch rather than a supreme branch. And the presidency had easily become the most powerful branch because of the Cold War, because the president is the only person in the government responsible for nuclear weapons. I mean, for the use of them. So in the 1970s, we had a series of really important laws passed by Congress, signed by a Republican president first, Gerald Ford, and then a Democratic president, Jimmy Carter, which basically put limits on presidential power and gave citizens more power and made our government more transparent. All of these were efforts to undo what Nixon tried to do. And the thing about Nixon is that if you don't listen to the tapes, what he did, you know, the evidence is clear. He engaged in abuse of power. But what you don't know is what he really wanted to do, which is massively more abuses of power. But the system stopped him. And the system that stopped him was a Republican system. Republicans in his own government said no to him repeatedly. And the evidence, I mean, it's really clear. He wanted to use the IRS against his enemies in a way that President Trump is probably doing. And he was stopped by his own commissioner of the IRS, by two of them. And he was stopped by his secretary of the Treasury. He wanted to deprive universities of federal money in a way that President Trump is doing right now. He was stopped by the Office of Management and Budget. He was told, Mr. President, this is illegal. We can't do this. We can't make up these reasons just because you don't like the fact that MIT is allowing anti-Vietnam demonstrations. We can't stop giving them money for science programs if they meet the criteria of those grant institutions. So those were Republicans who were doing that against their president. And their president, Nixon, for a number of reasons, would try hard and then give up. He was more the taco in that sense.
But that says something about the Republican Party, that it
says it says a lot, Madeline. Not about, because I'm trying to, it says a lot about Americans. It says a lot about conservatives. It's about good government. There were people who were called good government Republicans, good government conservatives. They were called the goo-goos, I guess, by some. And they were, some were liberal, but not all of them were liberal. I mean, George Shultz wasn't that liberal, but he believed in government. He just wanted government to be smaller. He disagreed with Lyndon Johnson. He thought that the Great Society was inefficient. But he liked the goals. He just thought the means were wrong. You know, George H.W. Bush knew that climate change was happening. He just wanted to trade carbon. You know, he wanted to find a way to make a green economy consistent with capitalism. So these were good government Republicans. They have disappeared. Not from the earth. They just don't have power anymore. I mean,
Don't you think what you're talking about is a general basic faith in government working, in the government institutions. And from what you've outlined with the Great Recession, the Iraq War, where those are two huge government failures, foreign policy and domestic policy, it's understandable that people on both sides think, you know what, it doesn't work. It hasn't in a while. So I guess my question is that an extreme position if most people now believe that government is not really working for them? And is it any surprise that there would be this knock-on result of people, you know, feeling this kind of extreme isolation in terms of their political beliefs?
I'm not surprised. I mean, but...
And I guess the question is, like, how do you get that back if the genie's out?
Well, but, you know, here's the thing about being a teacher. You can't be a teacher and be a cynic. And you've got to have... No, if you are, you're a terrible teacher. You shouldn't be in the business, right? So you've got to have a sense of possibility and that everyone is capable, including the teacher, of growth, okay? There are fixes for a number of our problems. They're not easy fixes, but there are fixes. The question is, when will we be able to develop trust in, I hate to use the word expertise because it makes people seem fancy, but that what we have today is we have a proliferation of influencers, but not a proliferation of expertise. And we've sort of monetized hate and provocation. Mm-hmm. And some of the fixes are pretty boring, but they might really help us. Let me give you a few examples, okay? I'm not running for anything, so I can tell you. Part is the whole question of gerrymandering, okay, which is an undermining, I mean, could have the effect of undermining democracy by diluting votes. Gerrymandering is as old as this country. This is not something new. It was not started by MAGA. It's been around. But we could deal with it the way other countries have. See, there are many Americans who would like proportional representation. They say, well, we have a diverse society and these voices, there's a sort of a similarity of certain voices and they should have elected representation. And so what they want is a proportional representation system. Well, we don't have that. That's not what we have. I'm not saying whether we should or we shouldn't, but we don't. What we have is a first past the post parliamentary system, even though it's a republic, right? But you know, you get one more vote than the other person running against you. You are the elected person. Countries that have that particular system recognize that if you're not careful about how you define your districts, you are going to dilute votes. So Canada, Australia, United Kingdom, New Zealand, what they all have is an independent commission that decides how to draw the districts. Now, those who are listening from California, I know. Yes, but here's the flaw. It's not a flaw. It's just the nature of our system. In our system, we don't have a federal approach to elections because our founders said it should be done by the states. So the problem here is a matter of rules. California did institute an independent commission. I believe New York did too. I'm not sure how independent it was, but I think everybody felt that. Maybe I won't. I used to live in California, but I thought that the California Commission seemed independent. But anyway,
it was.
But if the other states aren't doing it, then you know you begin to wonder, and particularly when you have a president who's saying, "I don't want any of you. I want you all to redistrict." Saying to red states. There's no incentive to be the good people, right? But independent commissions in 50 states would solve this problem.
But that's not going to happen because it's not going to help anyone who's politically in power at this point.
But here's my pious hope. Here's my hope, which is right now, if you look at the sweepstakes that the president set in motion, some people argue that it was Kathy Hochul here in New York. It's President Trump who did this, in this case. It may be a wash. This may be a wash. I'm not talking about Republicans losing Republican districts, because they might well, given the price of gas and the unpopularity of the president in November. But it may be a wash with all these games. And maybe if these politicos recognize that this nonsense only produces, it's a wash, that might take the steam out of this. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, after the Supreme Court's decision, the Calais decision, I don't know if that's the case, because as we just saw today, Memphis is now going to be likely redrawn into Republican districts, this majority Black district, the only Democratic district in the entire state of Tennessee after this decision. And other southern states are going to do the same.
Yes. And what I want to say, I'm not speaking today as a lawyer, because I'm not a lawyer. What I found interesting about an otherwise concerning decision was that the conservative majority did not overturn the 1986 voting rights Supreme Court decision. In fact, there was a test of that decision set out that it altered, but it didn't overturn it, nor did it declare unconstitutional the 1982 amendment to the Voting Rights Act, which is really the basis for this majority-minority district. It also didn't say it was unconstitutional. It found a way to keep those in place, but make an argument about the amount of proof you need that something has been done for racial as opposed to partisan reasons. I'm not saying that's great. What I'm saying is that it leaves the door open for other cases where efforts to dilute minority votes could fail, even in before this Supreme Court. It won't be easy, but for example, we'll see. But I think if Louisiana eliminated both of these majority-minority districts, that if you took the case to this, even this Supreme Court, Louisiana would lose. Now, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm not saying this is good. I'm just saying that this court, given its proclivities, could have actually overturned completely the amendment to the Section 2. I know we're in the weeds here, but I want to keep further my conversation, our conversation about good government Republicans. The basis for what Louisiana was doing was a compromise by Bob Dole, who was the Senate Majority Leader in 1982, and was really the person who pushed through that amendment to this Section 2, Bob Dole, a Republican. So it was a different era, but I just want to keep in mind people to understand that America isn't gone forever. It's not clear to me that the current America is the America for the future, because never in our history have we repeated ourselves forever. We are various forms of ourselves, and I'm not convinced that the era of Bob Dole or George Herbert Walker Bush or that it's gone forever. They'll look different, they'll sound differently, but some of those ideas of good government republicanism or good government conservatism, I don't think they're dead forever.
But okay, do you see any stirrings and any positive any candidates that you're interested in that could be running either, you know, in the midterms or for the next presidential race, who are really taking on the roots of what you've been talking about, which is this inequality, this feeling that the rules, they're being broken by everyone. I'm not getting a fair shake. And it really does come down to economics, economic inequality. And the wealth accumulation, and especially by this current president, has just been off the charts. And at the very top, the wealth accumulation, and everyone else kind of have to pick up the pieces below. Do you see any movement to change that in any substantial way? Because you could argue that the roots of all of this go back to Reagan changing the tax code and it becoming increasingly unequal in the decades since, and neither Democrats nor Republicans have really changed it much in administrations. So talk about that a little bit, if you would.
Well, I see a lot of hope in the fact that young people are interested in politics. I see a lot of good that can come out of populism. I'm saying this as someone who's not a democratic socialist, and I'm not likely to become one. But what I think is important is I think the idea of affordability is a very powerful one. And it's an idea that is bipartisan. It's actually nonpartisan. And if you lean into that idea, let's have a debate about it. Let's have a debate about, you know, why the American dream has changed, why it's no longer realistic. The dream that the generation of good government Republicans, the Bob Dole, the World War II generation, that their dream, and even the baby boomers' dream, is not realistic for Gen X and Gen Z and Gen Y. And that's a great conversation, and it's better to have a conversation than to give up. I mean, what I worry about are people just want to tear down the system and give up and say it can't work. So I'm very excited by pragmatic populists.
I know who is a pragmatic populist?
Ah, well, the mayor of New York,
Mamdani.
Yeah, I don't engage in handicapping races, and that's not what I do. But I also try not to make up my mind. I mean, I do participate, I do vote, but I mean, try not to make my mind about a candidate until I see them in office. And one of the things that's so interesting about the mayor is that he seems to be playing the long game, and he's making pragmatic choices, thinking about the long game. I think at times AOC does the same in the House, but she doesn't have much power. She has a lot of influence, but she doesn't have much power. Whereas the mayor has a lot of power. He has not as much power as he would like, but he has power. And I think he's shown himself to be a pragmatic populist. And that I would differentiate him from some of AOC's colleagues in the House who acted in the first 2 years of the Biden administration as if Biden had won a landslide and tried to push through this huge Build Back Better bill that was never going to pass. And it looked like it was virtue signaling by a lot of them. And you know, they had power, and they could have passed family leave. You know, they've chosen one thing, they might have gotten it, but they wanted it all. And they didn't understand the Senate. They thought that, oh, it's all because of Manchin and Sinema. You know, the two independent Democrats, it's their fault. No. They were just stalking horses. There wasn't enough support among Democrats in the Senate. So that's the opposite. Those are, you know, they're populists or progressives, as often they're the same, who were not pragmatic. And the effect of it was not much, right? In fact, it made Biden look weak. And when Biden did get a bipartisan bill passed, the progressives were really quite critical of it. So those populists who are seeking affordability and are willing to be pragmatic and play the long game, you can only do that if you're young. If you're in your late 50s and 60s, you want to do it now. But if you're 30s and 40s, you've got time. I think they could help restore trust in institutions, and not just on the left.
And how do you feel about Graham Plattner?
Well, you know,
the tattoo.
I don't wear tattoos, but I don't criticize people for their tattoos. but I do think people should have judgment. But look, if if Mr. Plattner, because I looked at his platform and there's nothing unusual about it. But there is a lot that has to do with Maine, and a lot he would be the first, I think, commercial fisherman to be in the Senate. There's a lot that they could do to bring
that he's a Maine. He did four tours of duty. Do you find that significant?
Well, I think that's not only significant. I think it's essential. It's not new in our politics. If you look at the number of veterans who served in Congress in the 60s, at 50s and 60s after World War II, and it was less so after Vietnam, although we had Vietnam veterans who served in Congress. No, I think it's very healthy for Congress to reflect the experience of people who served our country, because Congress, in a normal presidency, would play some role in at least shaping the way in which we use violence abroad. So I think it's great. I think that it's very important for Democrats as well as Republicans to recruit service people, because you don't want one of our parties to be viewed as pro-military and one to be anti-military. It's not healthy for our country, because our military is, again, people would like to make it partisan. President Trump, with the help of Secretary Hegseth, they've tried really hard to, you know, with their Patton movement, where they basically brought all these leaders in to Washington, to the Pentagon, so the president could give some speech. They really want to make it partisan. But we are safest and healthiest when our military is non-political. And so both parties should have military veterans in elected positions, I think.
Okay, let us get to a couple of questions, working from the bottom up. Many asked, including Alan, Bob, Jim, and others, how many of the most serious problems we are having are a result of the Supreme Court rulings? Politicians pass through and leave, but the justices and the rulings persist. For example, Citizens United, didn't that result in a huge distrust of the system that it can be bought and controlled by whomever has the most money, and we don't even get to know where the money is coming from? So that's a question from many people. Is the corruption of money in politics, or the corruption of politics by money, as enabled by the Supreme Court?
Well, I'd like to, if I may, take that question and divide it a little bit. Let's talk about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is not a democratic institution, but it is a constitutional institution. A lot of us grew up in an era where the Supreme Court made hard calls that Congress was too cowardly to make. The Supreme Court basically had a sense of where American culture and politics was going, and went in that direction. That's great if the direction is where you want to go, but it's not so good if it's not the direction you want to go. It's not actually a sign of a very healthy country if we rely on nine people to do the heavy lifting for our democracy. I'm glad it happened when Brown versus Board of Education was before my time, but certainly have influenced the world I saw. Roe v. Wade, the later decisions regarding same-sex marriage, the Miranda ruling. I mean, there are so many that are important to understanding our rights. Roe v. Wade is no longer a national right, but the point is the court seemed to be moving in a direction that American culture was moving in. And then we had a counter-revolution. And those people thought that the court was undemocratic and didn't represent them. And it's true, it didn't represent them. They disagreed with it. And so their view was, hey, we want to control it because they controlled it. And so they came. But wow. My point is, the reason I'm pulling this out is, I think the solution is not the court. I think the court has done some things that have to be fixed. But I'll get to that in a moment. But I think people who focus on the court don't recognize that the Warren Court and the Berger Court, by the way, the name Warren is in both, so it's a really confusing. It's, you know, Earl Warren and Warren Berger. It sounds like the same man, but it's not. they were leading in a certain, I would say, small L liberal direction. And a lot of conservatives were angry, and then we're now living through the counter-revolution. But the court shouldn't, that's the center of our activity should be Congress, and Congress has been dysfunctional. And the court has basically stepped in to do things Congress wouldn't do. And same with the president. Presidents have stepped in. I mean, President Obama used executive orders, and so did President Biden. Stepped in because Congress wouldn't do things. So at heart here is we've been dealing with a paralyzed Congress for a long time. Could do things, for example, like there are fixes for Social Security that could be done, and Congress won't do them. So I would focus on that. Now let's talk about corruption. Corruption should be part of the platform of every young person running for office in this country, left or right, because it's everywhere. Right now, the government is a right government, a right-wing government, and it is the source of most corruption. But if you look historically at our country, both parties have engaged in corruption. I think that is a winning issue because nothing smells like inequality and unfairness more than corruption. And now it's blatant. We have a government that's not even trying to hide it. We have a government, and national security stuff is sort of was my bread and butter, and I love studying it. We have a government that is making very clear to everybody that it's going to go and it's going to resolve your war if you give us something in return. And it's not like they're giving us Americans something in return. No, they're giving the Mar-a-Lago lobby something in return. Business opportunities, either in Armenia or the Democratic Republic of Congo, or maybe Greenland, although I hope not, and that story hasn't been written yet. But all of these cases are of corruption, of White House sponsored official corruption. Now, I'm not holding my breath that young Republicans, particularly after what just happened in Indiana, where the president's retribution seemed to work at least in 5 of the 7 cases against those that had opposed redistricting Indiana in the middle of a decade. But on the left and the Democrats, I mean, the corruption it's enormous. And my feeling is that Americans really don't like corruption. Some would say,
Say on the left, it's enormous. What do you mean?
I'm saying that this is a great
opportunity.
Greater opportunity. The opportunity for the left is enormous.
Right. So
but yeah. I'm not anticipating the right to make this argument, but it's a great argument for future Republicans to say, look what the older generation did to us. Because frankly, the spoils here are not being shared among Republican voters. It's not like the Trump administration's mercantilist approach to foreign policy is providing Iowa farmers and their allies in the South with benefits. In fact, the opposite is happening because the tariffs are not benefiting many, many Republican voters. So corruption should be part of any successful political campaign in the future, because right now it is absolutely blatant. And I don't believe that Americans will stomach more of it, because it is by nature unfair. And unfairness is one of the reasons for the toxic political culture that we live in now.
Yeah. So are you referring to just the blatant, the airplane and the crypto investments and that kind of stuff, all of that, or something more endemic in our political system, which is what the listeners, the viewers were saying about the political donations corrupting our politicians and our whole political system?
Well, that's
what Americans can sniff out as another reason why they don't believe in institutions, because they're bought and paid for by lobbyists.
Well, yes. And and Citizens United is the case that people should cite, where I guess we're made the argument that companies were individuals that had the right to vote, which is sort of weird. In a sense, had a right to support a political candidate. They couldn't actually go and vote. But we used to be capable of passing spending, campaign spending laws. I'm just not convinced that's all over. I mean, we have a new generation of people who are going to want power and deserve it. And they just have to recognize that playing by the rules in the end benefits them more than it doesn't help them. And by the way, I think what's going to be the evidence of this, and I don't want this to happen. I don't want us to suffer as a people. We have suffered enough. But I think the instability and the inefficiency and the corruption of the current administration should be an object lesson for even young Republicans that there is a reason why we had founders that set up rules. There's a reason why they were amended, because as we know, those rules were not universally fair by any stretch. And that this country is a work in progress, and people have to take control of their destiny. And then that's why I'm an optimist about young people. If they seize the opportunity to take control, that will restore some trust in government. I think that, again, get back to the mayor of New York, his experience thus far, I think, has renewed a sense of trust in government among young people. And I hope his sort of more conservative doppelganger will do well somewhere in Texas and will do somewhere in Alabama. It doesn't have to be a socialist. It's just a young person who wants to shake things up because the way things are right now aren't fair.
Okay, this is an interesting question from Leonard. If you, and I'm just putting you on the spot, and no, you're not a constitutional lawyer. However, if you could make three immediate amendments to the Constitution, what would they be?
I would weaken the president's pardon power. I wrote a piece in the first Trump administration about the use of the pardon for the Atlantic, which you might find interesting. I think that's a mistake, and I think the president has the ability to get a lot. He has enablers around him doing things that are wrong, and they know that they can be pardoned. And I think the January 6th pardon has laid the ground for the turbulence in our political culture right now. So I would amend the pardon power. Secondly, I would find a way to put that the intentions of a president when she or he does something for national security purposes matter. Their motives matter. If they're saying it's a national security issue, but really their objective is political and personal and pecuniary, they shouldn't be protected by immunity. So in other words, in the first Trump administration, when the president decided not to give support to Ukraine because he really wanted dirt on the Bidens, he shouldn't have been immune from that.
Why not just have an amendment that would overrule Trump v. U.S.?
That's not Well, no, I thought he meant, I'm sorry, I thought the question was amendment to the Constitution.
It is, but maybe you could have an amendment saying president.
I don't think you could just have a new court. I don't know how you would. No, I think you'd have a new court. The third is I would finally add the Equal Rights Amendment.
Do you think we need
finally ratify
that? What would that do? I would love to have that, but I don't know what that would actually do.
Well, I just think it's part of a different conversation, but part of what we're going through is a social change that has to do with the empowerment of women and the effect on men. I mean, so I talked about a lot of other large changes. This is a huge change. And I don't know. I just think it was very sad for this country wasn't able to do this, even if it's just symbolic. But I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I think it would have some implications. But I and I do believe that that's one of the sort of the shifts that is poisoning our not the empowerment of women, but the way in which some young men and their fathers have responded to this, I think has led to some of the difficulties that we have, not all of them, but some. So that was the Third Amendment that came to mind immediately, because I hadn't thought about this before.
I know, I did put you on the spot. Okay, so lots of questions around this general idea that people are worried that Trump will in some way subvert the elections, maybe declare martial law, somehow force the midterms not to happen, or to do something that would in some way guarantee that not only Republicans retain control of Congress, that or perhaps he can run for a third term.
Yep. Okay. I have thought about this. So first things first, I was looking to see how he responded in 2018.
By the way, 1 minute.
Oh, okay. Vote, carry your phone, we need evidence if any efforts are made to subvert our election, but most importantly, vote. I was in Hungary for the election. It's a different country. It's not by any stretch of the imagination as diverse as ours, much smaller too, but it was a country there where they overturned an authoritarian regime, or more importantly, a person who acted like an autocrat, and they did it by voting. And they did it by voting overwhelmingly. And he, his name is Orban, and he conceded the night of the election. And he conceded, partly he's different from Trump, because President Trump, as you know, probably will never concede when he loses of any kind. But it was an overwhelming, so it was such an overwhelming vote that it couldn't be hidden. It couldn't be massaged. And I think the key is an overwhelming vote in November in favor of constitutionalism in our democracy. That's the most important thing. Yes, we can worry about what he might do, but let's make it hard for an authoritarian to take our vote away from us and do it peacefully through massive voting. That to me is the key. We can have this conversation in December if things work out differently, but right now, mobilize, vote, get your friends to vote, and don't lose trust in each other.
Oh, that's a great note to end on. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Madeline.
It's a pleasure speaking with you and having you on the show. I really learned a lot, and it was just wonderful. Thank you.
Thanks, Madeline. It's my pleasure. Thank you all for participating.
Thank you, and I'll see you next time.